Om namaste. We're in the second of three chapters that Sri Aurobindo wrote in this first series in Essays on the Gita about the nature of the avatar, the one who descends. This chapter, when it came out in book form, was retitled The Process of Avatarhood, and you'll remember that it was published in November 1917. Well, there's a distinction between the ascent of the human-bound consciousness, gaining liberation from identification with the senses, with the body, with the ego, with all that is material, vital, or mental, and getting free from that form, merging the consciousness into the still transcendence above and beyond all, or into a deep identification and communion with the Supreme Being. That is a great liberation. That is not what we mean by avatarhood. So Sri Aurobindo is using this chapter to demonstrate how it is that the Supreme, comprising all the terms of being, and remember how in the Life Divine and the Synthesis of Yoga, he's come again and again to the idea that real being is transcendent and universal and individual all at one time. That the Supreme constitutes all possible existences, all states of being, all planes of being. So, if that's so, it ought to be possible for the Divine to place herself or himself directly into universal play, but also to occupy a personal, individual position within the context of that universal manifestation, and to be able to enter into and to remove from participation as it wishes, as she wishes, as he wishes. This intentional, deliberate manifestation of the Godhood through the powers of its own being is what we mean by avatar. Avatar is a descent, not by fall, but by I want to say swan dive again. that the Supreme, the swan who floats on the waters of all being, has come here purposefully and is not immured in darkness in the coming, but continues to exist on the tablature of the water, if you will. The feet very much moving below, powerfully gaining traction in the water. Head always aloft, nobly erect, gazing back to that from which it came. It's a beautiful image. So we speak of the divine incarnation often as not simply the Hansa, the swan, but the Paramahansa, the great one, the great swan who comes. Well, I divagate. I apologize. Back to our chapter here in the process of avatarhood. Sri Aurobindo is going to get more directly now into what it means to descend. Can I do this successfully? Maybe not. On the other hand, he writes, this entering into the divine consciousness may be attended by a reflex action of the divine entering or coming forward into the human parts of our being, pouring himself into the nature, the activity, the mentality, the corporeality even, of the man. And that may well be at least a partial avatarhood. So this is the action above perhaps Buddha or a sage sitting in a forest gaining access into the divine self, the Atman, or dissolving the fictitious ego and entering into nirvana, the blowing out. That's one thing. But here, an entering of the divine consciousness, a reflex action, could come back, you see. And once freed, that reflex could come back into the being and anoint it with powers unknown before. Can pour itself into the human parts of our being. So there would be a descent, a downward movement into the interior parts of the nature, what Sri Aurobindo in his letters would call the subliminal parts, and then moving from behind into the frontal nature. Do you see what I mean? And then, if that happens, you see that descent merging itself into the human personality could stand as a presentation of this conscious descent. Again, it's not exactly what the Gita means, but that is one way of looking at it. He continues, "The Lord stands in the heart," says the Gita, Hridaye Tishtate, 1861, by which it means, of course, the heart of the subtle being, the notice of the emotions, sensations, mental consciousness, where the individual Purusha also is seated. But he stands there veiled, enveloped by his Maya. Yoga Maya Samavrittaha, 725. But above, on a plane within us now, pardon me, but above, on a plane within us, but now superconscient to us, called heaven by the ancient mystics, the Lord and the Jiva stand together, revealed as of one essence of being, the Father and the Son of certain symbolisms, the divine being and the divine man who comes forth from him, born of the higher divine nature, the Virgin Mother, para prakriti, para maya, into the lower or human nature. There's a footnote. Sri Aurobindo writes, in the Buddhist legend, the name of the mother of Buddha makes the symbolism clear. Her name was Maya. And remember, this is 1,000 years before Shankara comes and helps add the twist to the term Maya that makes her into a cunning cheat, a deceiver. Maya, going back to the Vedic terminology again, which Sri Aurobindo has brought forward powerfully, is that power of the divine consciousness, often seen as feminine, who takes the infinite and measures it out, makes the infinite finite. Not a concealer, not a deceiver, but she's making it interesting. Here's a figure representing something larger. What does it mean to you? So he goes on, makes the symbolism clear. In the Christian, the symbol seems to have been attached by a familiar mythopoeic process to the actual human mother of Jesus of Nazareth. If you remember, Buddha's mother had a dream of who was coming. She had a dream of a white elephant. And she's said to have had his birth through her side, whatever that may connote. She died a week later, and he was raised by his mother's sister, who became the first nun in the Buddhist order after Buddha agreed to permit women to come into practice of Buddhism. So these terms, para prakriti, means supreme higher nature, and para maya means supreme or higher maya. So this is not, again, that connotes, that is not a phrase, para maya. That is a phrase that does not occur in the Gita, so far as I know, but does call to us the idea of something beyond, something greater, not the lower confusing maya that we may meet with our engagement with senses and stuff here in the material world, but something from a diviner world. Anyway, back to his treatment of this theme. This seems to be the inner doctrine of the Christian incarnation. In its Trinity, the Father is above in this inner heaven. The Son, or Supreme Prakriti, become Jiva of the Gita, descends as the divine man upon earth in the mortal body. The Holy Spirit, pure self, Brahmic consciousness, is that which makes them one, and that also in which they communicate. For we hear of the Holy Spirit descending upon Jesus, and it is the same descent which brings down the powers of the higher consciousness into the simple humanity of the apostles. So above is the God or Godhead. And then using the Holy Spirit as Brahman in Sanskrit terminology, as that which unifies, congeals all together, it is the one being. And then appearing in the individual. So God in the universe, in the individual. Again, the three terms of existence. So it's interesting that Sri Aurobindo finds some comparisons and some concordances among these things. We seem always to be talking about the same deep experiences. So when we find our own deep inner self, not only do we connect with the universal all and with that which supports the universe, but necessarily, if we dwell there and live in communion with that deepest soul, then we must ignite at some point a recognition of our commonality with the Supreme Being and recognize that it is that which stands in us, in the heart of our being, Hridaye Tishtati. But also, the higher divine consciousness of the Purushottama may itself descend into the humanity and that of the Jiva disappear into it. Hallelujah. This is said by his contemporaries to have happened in the occasional transfigurations of Chaitanya, when he, who in his normal consciousness was only the lover and devotee of the Lord and rejected all deification, became, in these abnormal moments, the Lord himself, and so spoke and acted with all the outflooding light and love and power of the divine presence. Now, Chaitanya is only a few centuries ago. He was a great example of the bhakti tradition. In fact, most people, when they think of the bhakti tradition, immediately think of him first. And so he was so devoted to the Supreme that that communion that he felt, the presence of Krishna that he felt, could deepen into an identity. And then those about him would see him take on the manner, the characteristics, become, to their eyes and experience and active realization, the incarnate divine in front of him. So then he was the Lord. In And then it would fade, and he would never claim, no, it isn't me, it's the divine coming and presenting. So this idea has led many in India to think of Chaitanya, even if he wasn't a full avatar, at least an Amsha avatar. He was a partial incarnation. It would come and go. Well, here Sri Aurobindo continues to write, and let's see what he has to say. This is said by his contemporaries to have happened in the occasional transfigurations of Chaitanya, when he who in his normal consciousness was only the lover and devotee of the Lord and rejected all deification, became in these abnormal moments the Lord himself, and so spoke and acted with all the outflooding light and love and power of the divine presence. Supposing this to be the normal condition, the human receptacle to be constantly no more than a vessel of this divine presence and divine consciousness, we should have the avatar according to this intermediary idea of the incarnation. So between perhaps the enlightened being and the full Purnavatara that we would see later with Krishna. That easily recommends itself as possible to our human notions. For if the human being can elevate his nature so as to feel a unity with the being of the divine, and himself, a mere channel of its consciousness, light, power, love, his own will and personality lost in that will and that being, and this is a recognized spiritual status, then there is no inherent impossibility of the reflex action of that will, being, power, love, light, consciousness, occupying the whole personality of the human jiva. And this would not be merely an ascent of our humanity into the divine birth and the divine nature, but a descent of the divine Purusha into humanity, an avatar. So this is the greater point. This descent can come and, in a sense, subsume the human personality to its own being and purposes. Perhaps it would be useful to note, just by way of discrimination, that often a mystic, someone who's building spiritual experiences, can have this identification in their core inner experience with the divine and mistranslate the experience, because perhaps the ego is not altogether abolished, and think they themselves are that. And we have had several, within just the last few decades, who have said, I have this realization and I am the avatar. I have succeeded Krishna. I am that. Etc., etc. Let them speak. You hear what you hear, you see what you see. The Gita, however, goes much farther. It speaks clearly of the Lord Himself being born. Chapter 4, Shloka 5, and again 13:28. Krishna speaks of his many births that are past and makes it clear by his language that it is not merely the receptive human being, but the divine of whom he makes this affirmation, because he uses the very language of the Creator, the same language which he would employ when he has to describe his creation of the world. Quote, although I am the unborn Lord of creatures, I create, loose forth myself by my Maya. That's 4:6. Presiding over the actions of my Prakriti, my nature. Here, There is no question of the Lord and the human jiva, or of the Father and the Son, the divine man, but only of the Lord and his prakriti. The divine descends by his own prakriti into birth in its human form and type, and brings into it the divine consciousness and the divine power, though consenting, though willing to act in the form, type, mold of humanity, and he governs its actions in the body as the indwelling and overdwelling soul, Adishtaya. Again, 4:6. From above, he governs always indeed, for so he governs all nature, the human included. From within also he governs all nature, always, but hidden. The difference here is that he is manifest, that the nature is conscious of the divine presence as the Lord, the inhabitant. And it is not by his secret will from above, the will of the Father which is in heaven, but by his quite direct and apparent will that he moves the nature. And here, there seems to be no room for the human intermediary, for it is by resort to his own nature, prakritim svam, and not the special nature of the jiva, that the Lord of all existence thus takes upon himself the human birth. Come here intentionally. And this ought to remind you of Sri Aurobindo's writing of the mother in the book, The Mother, how she assumes her place in this world, dwells within all beings, carries them, drives them, encourages them according to their nature to grow and prosper in the ways of the ignorance, or to arrive finally at divine doors and live here in a divine life. So that teaching of the Gita carries over very much to this very moment. But the divine is not plunging forcefully into birth here as an accident. It is not that he's sentencing himself to slavery in darkness, but come in here for a purpose. Now, this is interesting. This doctrine is a hard saying, a difficult thing for the human reason to accept, and for an obvious reason, because of the evident humanity of the avatar. So Christianity is making, well, not simply Christianity, but theism is making its way into here, various sentences that he's writing. Hard sayings or dark utterances are things that are well known in Christianity and in Judaism. In Daniel 5:12 and John 6:60, you have such things. There are many, many hard sayings, things which seem to perplex, which challenge, which demand that you believe, that you can't solve the riddle with the power of your intellect. So this doctrine of the descending Godhead, is a hard saying, a difficult thing for the human reason to accept. And for an obvious reason, because of the evident humanity of the avatar. God, come here, Purushottama, in a human vehicle, but he's beyond the universe, contains the universe. How can he also be here in a human body? The avatar is always a dual phenomenon of divinity and humanity. The divine takes upon himself the human nature with all its outward limitations, and makes them the circumstances, means, instruments of the divine consciousness and the divine power, a vessel of the divine birth and the divine works. But so surely it must be, since otherwise the object of the avatar's descent is not fulfilled. For that object is precisely to show that the human birth, with all its limitations, can be made such a means and instrument of the divine birth and divine works, precisely to show that the human type of consciousness can be compatible with the divine essence of consciousness made manifest, can be converted into its vessel, drawn into nearer conformity with it by a change of its mold and a heightening of its powers of light and love and strength and purity, and to show also how it can be done. So the avatar uses the human birth to demonstrate, to become the living example. Yes, I accept all these human limitations, the ignorance, the passions, the errors, everything that you can possibly do wrong, I shall do. And I'll show you how to rise out of ignorance into knowledge, out of suffering into delight, out of darkness into illumination, and how to combine it all in a divine life. That's the purpose, to do it and to show it. And once shown, we might ignite, catch fire, and do it. So how does he do it? Through a change of consciousness. What changes consciousness? By golly, yoga changes consciousness. If the avatar were to act in an entirely supernormal fashion, this object would not be fulfilled. A merely supernormal or miraculous avatar would be a meaningless absurdity. Not that there need be an entire absence of the use of supernormal powers, such as Christ's so-called miracles of healing, for the use of supernormal powers is quite a possibility of human nature. But there need not be that at all, nor in any case is it the root of the matter, nor would it at all do if the life were nothing else but a display of supernormal fireworks. The avatar does not come as a thaumaturgic magician, but as a divine leader of humanity and the exemplar of a divine humanity. Thaumaturgic, from the Greek thaumaturgos, wonder worker. So whether Christ can restore people's life or, you know, make oceans of wine where there were only gallons of water before, that's not particularly at question here, because we want to see the divine act. We want to see how we can transfigure our humanity into that. We don't need the show. The show may occur. It's certainly possible for the eight cities described in the tantras to get realized in a human aspirant, and they'd be able to wield those powers. In fact, any powers possible in the universe ought to be wielded by the awakened yogi without attachment to them and without vanity, but as appropriate according to the will of the divine at an auspicious hour, Brahma Muhurta, the hour of God. Don't use them to show off. Even human sorrow and physical suffering he must assume and use so as to show first how that suffering may be a means of redemption, as did Christ. Secondly, to show how, having been assumed by the divine soul in the human nature, it can also be overcome in the same nature, as did Buddha. The rationalist who would have cried to Christ, "If thou art the Son of God, come down from the cross," or points out sagely that the avatar was not divine because he died, and died too by disease, as a dog dieth, knows not what he is saying, for he has missed the root of the whole matter. Even the avatar of sorrow and suffering must come before there can be the avatar of divine joy. The human limitation must be assumed in order to show how it can be overcome. And the way and the extent of the overcoming, whether internal only or external also, depends upon the stage of the human advance. It must not be done by a non-human miracle. In other words, we have to observe the process of life. We have to use the material conditions that we meet. Now, some of you may remember that years after Sri Aurobindo wrote this, he and the mother had founded the ashram. Life was going along, and mother saw the possibility that she could bring by precipitation into the earth's soil the supernature of the supramental realization. And Sri Aurobindo saw that she was developing this, and she spoke with him about it, and he said, yes, but that wouldn't be fair, because we are trying to evolve the new manifestation, the supramental appearance upon the earth. And if we simply did it this way, it would be tremendous, but it would be a shortcut, and we ought to do it the slow, deliberate way. Let's evolve it naturally. So she heard, she dissolved that formation, and they went ahead with their work. Much slower, but more sure. And it invites the participation of the globe. Certainly the divine can, in a single moment, with at the blink of an eye, transform material nature with all its difficulties by an act of will. There is no question. But this is a play of possibilities. And we're going to win the game according to the rules of the game. We shall change the rules of the game. The question then arises, and it is the sole real difficulty, for here the intellect falters and stumbles over its own limits. How is this human mind and body assumed? For they were not created suddenly and all of a piece, but by some kind of evolution, physical or spiritual or both. No doubt. The descent of the avatar, like the divine birth from the other side, is essentially a spiritual phenomenon, as is shown by the Gita's Atmanam Srijami 4:7. It is a soul birth. But still, there is here an attendant physical birth. How then were this human mind and body of the avatar created? If we suppose that the body is always created by the hereditary evolution, by inconscient nature and its immanent life spirit, without the intervention of the individual soul, the matter becomes simple. A physical and mental body is prepared, fit for the divine incarnation, by a pure or great heredity, and the descending Godhead takes possession of it. But the Gita, in this very passage, applies the doctrine of reincarnation boldly enough to the avatar himself. And in the usual theory of reincarnation, the reincarnating soul, by its past spiritual and psychological evolution, itself determines and in a way prepares its own mental and physical body. The soul prepares its own body. The body is not prepared for it without any reference to the soul. Are we then to suppose an eternal or continual avatar himself evolving, we might say, his own fit mental and physical body according to the needs and pace of the human evolution, and so appearing from age to age, yuge, yuge? In some such spirit, some would interpret the 10 incarnations of Vishnu first in animal forms, then in the animal man, then in the dwarf man-soul, Vamana, the violent Asuric man, Rama of the axe, the divinely natured man, a greater Rama, the awakened spiritual man, Buddha, and preceding him in time but final in place, the complete divine manhood, Krishna. For the last avatar, Kalki, only accomplishes the work Krishna began. He fulfills in power the great struggle which the previous avatars prepared in all its potentialities. And the second coming of Christ, by the way, is said to be one where he manifests his power. If this time it was compassion, next time he brings power. So empowerment. So Matsya, Kurma, Varaha, Narasimha, Vamana, Parashurama, Rama, Balarama, Krishna, Kalki. I'm not sure that Buddha actually qualifies. I think Sri Aurobindo is being kind to enumerate him there because he doesn't seem to have anything to do with Vishnu. If a manifestation of anything, probably a manifestation of Shiva. It is a difficult assumption to our modern mentality, but the language of the Gita seems to demand it, that the avatar manifests gradually over a period of time, evolves through the forms he, she occupies. Or since the Gita does not expressly solve the problem, we may solve it in some other way of our own, as that the body is prepared by the jiva, but assumed from birth by the Godhead, or that it is prepared by one of the four manus, chatvaru manavaha, of the Gita 10.6, the spiritual fathers of every human mind and body. This is going far into the mystic field from which the modern reason is still averse. But once we admit avatarhood, we have already entered into it, and once entered, may as well tread in it with firm footsteps. You might remember that Sri Aurobindo's writing in the teens. Theosophy was very much dominant in the West at the time in terms of spiritual, mystical philosophy. So Sri Aurobindo takes up here and there themes that were popular in Theosophy. There, the Gita's doctrine of avatarhood stands. We have had to advert to it at length in this aspect of its method, as we did to the question of its possibility, because it is necessary to look at it and face the difficulties which the reasoning mind of man is likely to offer to it. It is true that the physical avatarhood does not fill a large space in the Gita, but still, it does occupy a definite place in the chain of its teachings and is implied in the whole scheme, the very framework being the avatar leading the Vibhuti, the man who has risen to the greatest heights of mere manhood, to the divine birth and divine works. Remember, Krishna is leading Arjuna, who is a Vibhuti. No doubt, too, the inner descent of the Godhead to raise the human soul into himself is the main thing. It is the inner Christ, Krishna, or Buddha that matters. But just as the outer life is of immense importance for the inner development, so the external avatarhood is of no mean importance for this great spiritual manifestation. The consummation in the mental and physical symbol assists the growth of the inner reality. Afterwards, the inner reality expresses itself with greater power in a more perfect symbolization of itself through the outer life. You might go back and look at 4.9, which says in rough translation into English, who knows in its right principles my divine birth, and my divine work. When he abandons his body, comes not to rebirth, he comes to me, O Arjuna. Between these two, spiritual reality and mental and physical expression, acting and returning upon each other constantly, the manifestation of the divine in humanity has elected to move always in the cycles of its concealment and its revelation. Sometimes this teaching, sometimes the evidence of this is hidden and lost, and then later remembered and recovered and experienced again. So to rise out of ignorance and discover the soul, to then live in communion with the Supreme, and in a sense be possessed by the identifying power of the Supreme Consciousness. That lifts us into the state of being one with Purushottama. We become, again, the jiva from above, which we were from the beginning. We have recovered our status and can swan-like swim through the waters of the cosmos. So next week, we'll take up the divine birth and divine works, retitled then. And if you have patience enough, I will read to you a little section from Savitri. I think it's relevant. This is in book 7. Can I speak tonight? This is in book 7, the book of yoga, canto 2, the parable of the search for the soul. I think I'll begin on page 484. But this is only matter's first self-view, a scale and series in the ignorance. This is not all we are, or all our world. Our greater self of knowledge waits for us, a supreme light in the truth-conscious vast. It sees from summits beyond thinking mind. It moves in a splendid air transcending life. It shall descend and make earth's life divine. Truth made the world, not a blind nature force. For here are not our large diviner heights. Our summits in the superconscience blaze are glorious with the very face of God. There is our aspect of eternity. There is the figure of the God we are, his young unaging look on deathless things, his joy in our escape from death and time, his immortality and light and bliss. Our larger being sits behind cryptic walls. There are greatnesses hidden in our unseen parts that wait their hour to step into life's front. We feel an aid from deep and dwelling gods. One speaks within. Light comes to us from above. Our soul from its mysterious chamber acts. Its influence, pressing on our heart and mind, pushes them to exceed their mortal selves. It seeks for good and beauty and for God. We see beyond self's walls our limitless self. We gaze through our world's glass at half-seen vasts. We hunt for the truth behind apparent things. Our inner mind dwells in a larger light. Its brightness looks at us through hidden doors. Our members luminous grow, and wisdom's face appears in the doorway of the mystic ward. When she enters into our house of outward sense, then we look up and see above her sun, a mighty life self with its inner powers supports the dwarfish modicum we call life. It can graft upon our crawl two puissant wings. Our body's subtle self is throned within in its viewless palace of veridical dreams that are bright shadows of the thoughts of God. In the prone, obscure beginnings of the race, the human grew in the bowed, ape-like man. He stood erect, a godlike form and force, and a soul's thoughts looked out from earth-born eyes. Man stood erect. He wore the thinker's brow. He looked at heaven and saw his comrade stars. A vision came of beauty and greater birth slowly emerging from the heart's chapel of light and moved in a white, lucent air of dreams. He saw his beings, unrealized vastnesses. He aspired and housed the nascent demigod. Out of the dim recesses of the self, the occult seeker into the open came. He heard the far and touched the intangible. He gazed into the future and the unseen. He used the powers earth instruments cannot use, a pastime made of the impossible. He caught up fragments of the omniscient's thought. He scattered formulas of omnipotence. Thus, man, in his little house made of earth's dust, grew towards an unseen heaven of thought and dream, looking into the vast vistas of his mind on a small globe dotting infinity. At last, climbing a long and narrow stair, he stood alone on the high roof of things and saw the light of a spiritual sun. Aspiring, he transcends his earthly self. He stands in the largeness of his soul, newborn, redeemed from encirclement by mortal things, and moves in a pure, free, spiritual realm as in the rare breath of a stratosphere. A last end of far lines of divinity, he mounts by a frail thread to his high source. He reaches his fount of immortality. He calls the Godhead into his mortal life. All this the spirit concealed had done in her. A portion of the mighty mother came into her as into its own human part. Amid the cosmic workings of the gods, it marked her the center of a wide-drawn scheme, dreamed in the passion of her far-seeing spirit to mold humanity into God's own shape and lead this great, blind, struggling world to light, or a new world discover or create. Earth must transform herself and equal heaven, or heaven descend into earth's mortal state. But for such vast spiritual change to be, out of the mystic cavern in man's heart, the heavenly psyche must put off her veil and step into common nature's crowded rooms and stand uncovered in that nature's front and rule its thoughts and fill the body and life. Obedient to a high command, she sat. Time, life, and death were passing incidents, obstructing with their transient view her sight, that must break through and liberate the God imprisoned in the visionless mortal man. The inferior nature born into ignorance still took too large a place. It veiled herself and must be pushed aside to find her soul. That's the end of Canto 2. So, isn't it so? Ihaiva, here and now. Ihaiva. Huh. So, I bid you all adieu for the moment. I look forward to seeing you soon. Much love from Pensacola. Namaste, Jai Ma.